welcome back to the podcast for Cultural Reformation, brought to you by the Ezra Institute. For anybody who's watching or anybody who's listening, we are actually recording this. This is a Q&A session that we did at our Ezra Worldview Youth Academy in Southwestern Ontario. We are at the Rathfawn Inn in Port Colborne. We're having a great week. Are we having a good week, guys? So what we're doing for this is we had lectures today from Joe and from Cal. So this is Dr. Joe Boot, who should be familiar to all of you. And this is Cal Smith, who is the Canadian director of the Answers in Genesis ministry here in Canada. And these guys are here ready to answer some questions. So Joe was able to introduce us to Christian and creational worldview. Cal lectured a couple times on evolution and evolutionary biology and creational worldview as well. And so we've asked the students to kind of save up their questions, and what we're going to do is just fire them at Joe and Cal. So you guys ready to ask some questions?
Yeah.
Good job. Okay, you're just supposed to be loud a lot, okay? Just sound excited. Okay, so anybody who has a question, just throw your hand up, and I'll repeat it into the microphone so it gets recorded. And yeah, go ahead, Oliver.
This is for Calvin. You mentioned several times in your lectures of how you were not raised in a Christian family and that you eventually became Christian, and I was just wondering what your testimony was sort of like. Was it slow process of deduction, coming to the knowledge that there is a God and eventually choosing Christianity, or was it more of a quick revelation through some research?
So I'll just repeat the question so that it's recorded on the podcast. So Cal was just asked several times during his lecture, you talked about just your testimony. You grew up an atheist. So tell us a little bit about your testimony. Was it a one-and-done kind of big dark night of the soul, or was it a process that you were saved?
Yeah, it was definitely a process. Growing up in a non-Christian home, my understanding of origins was always from an evolutionary viewpoint. And so when I say I was an atheist, I wasn't like a Richard Dawkins. I wasn't writing a bunch of books, you know, trying to, you know, take down the Christian faith and all that stuff. I just lived my life like that. Like, there is no God. And when I was approached by people who wanted me to go to their church or their Bible study or something like that, I would politely decline and just say, oh, you know, it's not for me. But if you persisted and, you know, got in my face, so to speak, or I perceived it that way, then I would hit them with these questions. And it's interesting that these questions that I would hit them with are the same questions that I'm now answering, right? The Lord's got a sense of humor. You know, so you believe the story about a guy who got two of every animal on a boat, and how do you fit dinosaurs on, you know, and the typical things I answer and talk about now are what I ask questions for. And the typical response from Christians was they just run away. It's like they'd never read 1 Peter 3:15 and didn't have an answer for their faith. And the second most common response I got was from people trying to explain it away. Well, the story about the ark, it's just an analogy. And I'd be like, yeah, the part about the dead guy coming back to life, that's probably an analogy too. And so this was my understanding. And so the first time I ever heard someone challenge the story of evolution was when I got invited to this non-denominational service. And the only reason I attended is because I knew the man who was speaking and I respected him. I knew him casually from business, but I did respect him. He was a highly intelligent man in my estimation. And so I showed up at this service with a clipboard and a pen, and I was like very skeptical. I thought he was going to be shouting out Bible verses and thumping, you know, the Bible and all this stuff. And he did a lot of apologetics. You know, he'd studied medicine as a doctor and read Origin of Species, and he really poked a bunch of holes in the story of evolution. I've always been able to follow an argument fairly well. So I didn't walk out of that service saved, but I walked out of there really going, well, wait a sec, if evolution's not all it's cracked up to be, what's the only solution? Creator, a God, right? And when you think of the verse, those who come to him must come to him by faith, but must believe that he exists. Well, now I was a lot more open to thinking, well, God might exist, and, you know, maybe there's a different answer for this. So over the course of the year, the Lord was really working on me because I had two children by that point. They would go to church, Catholic church, with Nana every now and then, and they started asking me questions about God. I was like, well, I don't know, you know, with no church background whatsoever. And so I got a chance to go to see the same man speak exactly a year later. And this time I was a little more humble. I was a little more open. And again, he did some apologetics, but apologetics doesn't save anybody. The gospel
saves people. And so all my barriers were now down, so to speak, and he'd, you know, knocked out these stumbling blocks. And he started talking about God's law, you know, stealing, lying, committing adultery, all these things. And, you know, I just felt convicted. I was just like, literally my palms were sweating. I was just sitting there and I just felt conviction. Like, yeah, I'm guilty. And then he used a very interesting analogy, one that I've used ever since. And he said, you know, pretend on the day you're born, this invisible camera comes into being and it starts recording everything you do and you say and all those things you do when you don't think anybody's looking, right? And when you die, you stand in front of God. And it's like, I was taking this real personally at this point. So it was like, you know, I could just picture, you know, standing in front of God. It's like, hey, Cal, how you doing? You know, why don't we sit down on this cozy, comfy couch here and we're going to play the DVD of your life, watch it in slow motion, see if you're good enough to be with me in eternity. And I was like, honestly, I was sitting there so convicted in my mind. It was like a bad movie. It was like, no, you know, there were scenes, you know. And he said, but see, if you're a Christian at that point, it's like Jesus would come along and say, no, Father, don't play his DVD. Play my DVD, my life, as a substitute, and judge him based on my life, the perfect, sinless Son of God. And that is the first time I ever knew who Jesus was, what his mission was, or anything. And, you know, prior to that, Jesus was a swear word for me. And so, with very little Bible knowledge, never gone to church except for a couple weddings, I got saved, went home. I had a Bible somebody gave me and a tract that said, three steps, what just happened? And I remember sitting in my tub in Cambridge, Ontario, reading this thing going, yeah, what just happened? Because something just happened. But I had no way to understand my conversion experience because I just didn't have any church background. And so I just started reading the Bible. And I always joke with people, guess where I started?
Genesis,
because it's the start of the book. I wasn't educated enough to start in John or something like that. You know what I mean? And I just literally went from going, okay, God doesn't exist, to, wow, God created in 6 days, rested on the seventh. That's the way it happened. I mean, that, to me, that's the renewal of your mind. So it was shocking to me when I started meeting Christians that didn't take the Bible as plainly written, because it's just so evident what God's word has to say about that. So anyway, that's my truncated. I'll use the word truncated. You like that one. That's my truncated version of my testimony. My best Joe Boot.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing with us, Cal. That's good. Any other questions? Come on, don't be shy.
Wow, that was a
step. It's going to be a short podcast.
Yeah, seriously.
Questions.
Yeah, go for it. So the question was, what's the best argument for evolution? And I guess, how would that fail, or how would you respond to it?
Yeah. I just wrote a script, actually, for a new video, because we do a lot of video production here in Canada ever since COVID happened. So this is my shout out to our Answers in Genesis Canada YouTube channel. So go check that out. But the script had to do with the way evolution is described. And so I would say that one of the best arguments for evolution is just by, in a sense, dumbing down the specificity of what evolution means. So if you can convince people that evolution is just change in living things, that's the best argument. You know why? Because living things are changing all the time. And so I actually quote Dr. Eugenie Scott. She was the, she's an atheist and evolution promoter in the United States. And one of the quotes, I can't give it to you now because I don't have it off the top of my head, but she actually recommends defining evolution as modification in the offspring over time or something like that. Like, she really kind of brings it down to a lower level, where by that definition, even procreation of any sexually reproducing organisms would fall under the definition of evolution. So I think they just, you know, if you can just convince people, no, evolution is just change, then all the evidence points to it, because creatures change all the time. The point we're making with Answers in Genesis is, what kind of change would evolution have to be able to demonstrate? And that is a very specific kind of change, where you would demonstrate one creature gaining genetic information for forms, functions, and features that never before existed, so that you could see one creature turning into a different kind of creature. So if they say, you know, lizards turned into birds over millions of years or whatever, okay, is there any proof of that? Is there any observational proof of that? And so I think that's where their argument absolutely fails, because every time they try to promote what they would call macroevolution, big evolution, one thing turns into another, all they keep showing us is definitions of what they term microevolution. Look, these finches have different size beaks. Big deal. They're still finches. You know, these moths, these peppered moths, there used to be more light ones than dark ones, and now there's more dark ones than who cares? They're still bichin bichularia, peppered moths. So that's where I would say they would argue most positively from, and also how it's so easily debunked.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'll touch on this in my lecture on Wednesday, but interestingly, what you're describing is essentially a battle over definitions and words in the dictionary, right? And we see this even in our culture right now when it comes to things like climate change, right? It was global cooling, right? And then the data didn't support it. And then it was global warming, and then the data didn't support it. And so now it's just climate change, because we all know the climate changes. So if there's a hurricane, climate change. If there's wildfires.
It's job description.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Climate change. That's its job description. Yeah, that's what right. Climate is supposed to do, change.
Yeah, that's right. So if you can change the definitions, and then you can load something into that definition. So we all agree that there are small changes within a species. But if that's what they mean by evolution, and then they load in all this other origin story,
I've got something I could add to that too. I think there's three things that strike me as what people find or think is convincing about evolution, and some of it does have to do with these definitions. The first would be that people now conflate science with evolution. So when you reject an evolutionary viewpoint, people say, well, you don't believe in science? So they've actually identified a hypothesis of some scientists with empirical scientific knowledge. So they've conflated a philosophy with a methodology. Science is actually about a methodology of investigation, and they conflate their philosophical worldview with a methodology. So in the mind of the public, they think, oh, look, science is great. My cell phone, look at that, science, look how well it works. Evolution, that's science, brilliant, look how well it works. And they think that they're talking about the same kind of thing, that here's my cell phone, that's science. Here's evolution, that's science. And if you don't believe in evolution, therefore you're a denier of science. Now that trick has made evolution seem very compelling. The other argument that I think gives a sort of prima facie plausibility to evolution is the similarity of things. So we see similarity in creation between structures, between organisms and so on. And we think that similarity must mean common ancestry, whereas the biblical response to that is, well, if you've got a given designer who has and one author to a particular project, to a particular piece of art, then, which creation is as well, then you can expect similarity, right? So one designer, one, you recognize the designs of certain people in certain patterns. And so we see that we can expect a certain amount of similarity because there's one designer. Here's the third thing though, and I think this is the most significant of those things that I've mentioned. And it's actually the thing that impacted Charles Darwin. Darwin was actually not a professional scientist. He's actually went to university to study theology. And he was an amateur scientist in the sense that he was interested in geology. He knew Charles Lyell. He was interested in living things, and he was invited as a gentleman to go on this trip around the Galapagos Islands to make his scientific observations. And when he studied theology, you would think that he went to do a course of study in biblical theology, in understanding a biblical world and life view and so on. But that's actually not the case. What he studied in the universities at the time was a kind of rational theology. It was rationalism. And that rational theology basically held and taught that the universe is almost mathematically and mechanically perfect. It's perfectly ordered. It's perfectly structured. It has some of you may have heard of William Paley and his argument from design and discovering a watch and, you know, you'd think that there must be a watchmaker, the divine watchmaker, this perfect ordering and structure. And Darwin's learning this rational theology, but he's not actually learning a biblical world and life view of creation, fall, redemption, consummation. So when Darwin looks at the world, he says, well, I'm told I should expect this perfect mathematical order and structure and simplicity and perfection almost. And what I discover is nature red in tooth and claw. I see all this pain and suffering and death and disease and all of these things. How does that match with this rational theology I've been taught? And one of the reasons he started to move away from, he was already grown up in a deistic context, not a Christian theistic context. So there was no belief in the Trinitarian God in his upbringing, just an idea of a God who kicked the ball at the beginning of creation and left it to its own devices. Well, now he's looking at a world that looks broken, and he's been told to expect with Christianity a world that's perfectly ordered. Well, what's the biblical response to that? So people still look at the world today and they say, well, look at all the disease, look at all the death, look at all the suffering. Evolution surely accounts for that. But what does the biblical world and life view say? What does the biblical world and life view say to that? Why do we feel and sense that the world is broken? I mean, on an evolutionary paradigm, basically, death is the engine of life. So what are you complaining about? Death brings life. Suffering, disease, and all those sorts of things. This is just the process of history. This is the engine of life. There'd be no basis for complaint. We'd accept that as the way things are. But human beings don't. We say this is a problem. We actually call it the problem of evil. If Darwin had actually known a Christian world and life view properly and understood that there was a good creation that fell into ruin and alienation from God and thorns and thistles and death and disease and decay, then he could account for the world in which he saw in terms of a biblical theology. But because he had this rational philosophical theology, not a biblical world and life view, that it didn't mesh. And so that's the third thing I think that's compelling about the evolutionary account to many people is they say, well, you know, we talk about design and order and structure in a creationist worldview, but look at the mess in the world, look at the disease and suffering among the creatures. Oh, evolution accounts for that better. That makes it sound like a compelling story.
Yeah, and you kept mentioning the word methodology, and there's an actual term that many scientists operate under now called methodological naturalism. So it doesn't matter what you show. I mean, the number one question, if you said to somebody, well, if God created, what would you expect to find? What would you expect to find? Design. And now they're basically saying, yeah, but any evidence of design you find, that all came about through natural selection and mutations. So it doesn't matter what evidence you show them, they automatically take that and say, well, that happened through naturalistic processes. It's non-falsifiable. There's no way you can show evidence of God, because every time you show evidence of design, they just say, well, that's the result of evolutionary processes. So
everything is evidence for evolution.
Exactly.
That's why it's not a scientific theory.
I just did a video script a little while ago called The No-Win Scenario. And that's what's happening. It doesn't matter what you show. You just, you know, heads I win, tails you lose. It doesn't matter what evidence you show until you unveil the veil and think about it.
It's good. As you can see, you'll get very in-depth answers to every question that you ask. So any more questions, let's keep them rolling. Yeah, go for it. So the question is, if you're evangelizing and the person that you are sharing the gospel with is an atheist, what would sort of be one of the main things that you make sure that you touch on?
Go ahead.
Okay, so first thing, I think I would follow my friend Corey McKenna's advice. Get the gospel out there. That's the gospel seed you want. You can't you know, water or feed a seed that's not planted. So get the gospel in there. But I think a key concept that we at Answers in Genesis especially make that I think is so powerful is demonstrating to them the difference between operational and historical science. Because you know, as Joe mentioned with the last question, people respect science to a high degree. They love their cell phones. They love their laptops. They love, you know, all these things we get from science. So there's this reverence for science, so to speak. And when you say you don't believe in evolution, they're going, oh, this is a science denier. Like, this is a flat earther. This is like, you know, they're looking at you like you're this little Dumkin, right? And I remember doing that to Christians as well. As soon as they told me they didn't believe in evolution, I was like, oh, you know, in my brain, I was like putting them in a little box up on the shelf over here, like, oh, one of those people, you know? And so when you demonstrate to them like, hey, wait a sec, like I believe in science, you can repeat the experiment over and over again, you always get the same results. They're like, yeah. And then you go, right, so could you set up an experiment in a lab showing me ape-like creatures turning into people? Well, no, so you can't demonstrate evolution. Well, yeah, but there's a series of skulls and we think this one turned into that one and we believe this one. Oh, right. But you never observed it, right? So you can't set up an experiment and repeat it over and over again. So that's not the type of science that gives me this microphone and laptop computers and stuff. And all of a sudden when you show them that, it's almost frightening for them. They're like, you know, and I will just say to them, look, there isn't a fact that you and I observe that we don't agree with. And they're, what do you mean? There isn't a fact that we observe that we don't agree with. We walk up to the rock layers, there's a dead thing in there. There's a dead thing in there, right? Yeah, there's a dead thing. It's called a fossil. Good. And in behind that fact becomes, now we start explaining it. Oh, I think that's a 70 million year old, because it's a dinosaur. And I say, no, I think it got put there about 4,400 years ago because there was a great big flood on this planet. What kind of mechanisms would create that? And all of a sudden you're having a different conversation and you bypass this thing in their brain where they get to just blow you off like some little dumpkin. And all of a sudden they recognize, wait a sec, that's what happened to me. When I got put back on my own heels and I had to actually defend evolution, I was like, I realized something. I was on sinking sand. It wasn't as rock solid as it, you know, made it out to be. And so that difference between operational and historical science, that argument is a very powerful one because, you know, I don't expect to have a conversation with someone and then, you know, I just mention soft tissue and dinosaur and they drop to their knees and accept Jesus. Like, it's not going to happen for the most part, right? I'm looking for that longer conversation. I'm looking for that plant the seeds. And maybe I'm not even the guy. Sometimes I've had these conversations on planes when I'm off to go teach at a conference. And I leave and I've just planted a couple of seeds and maybe the Lord's going to bring someone else into their life and continue off of that, okay? But you're breaking down stumbling blocks, you're removing them, and you're planting seeds for the future sometimes. So that would be one thing I would say.
Yeah, I think I'm more of a philosopher than I am a sort of concrete science guy like Calvin. So I would think I would talk about Darwin's doubt, Darwin's own doubt about his own theorizing, which goes to the question of knowledge. Because he recognized that on his worldview, on his perspective, on his theory, his brain in his head was emergent from the brain of apes, pre-hominids, right? Monkeys of, you know. And so he said, Darwin himself said, who would trust the deliverances, the conclusions of a monkey's mind, right? So if you're going to validate, if you're going to validate something, you can appeal downward or you can appeal upward. So my scientific conclusions, and he recognized this, my scientific conclusions, how do I know they're accurate or true? How do I know that any sort of scientific perspective is true? He realized he was appealing downward to the animal mind. Why would a more advanced hominid, a human being within the evolutionary understanding of reality, why would you trust the brain of himself, Darwin, or any other hominid, any other Homo sapien, when it's emerged from amoeba, and a monkey? I never consult my dog to help me with my son's homework, right? Or to tell me about current affairs, or to help me with a philosophical question. He's an animal. So you can validate something in terms of what is below or what is above. Now, the Christian looks to a transcendent source to validate knowledge. God is our creator. He's above us. He transcends us. He orders all things. The evolutionist, Darwin recognized this, is appealing downward. He said, that's what they call it, Darwin's doubt. How can I trust the deliverances of my mind when it is just a brain that's emergent from that of a pre-hominid? And then I would go to the point I made in my worldview lecture today. You know, remember when I was talking about join the dot puzzles? the evolutionist basically says this world is a sea of brute factuality. It's just chaos. It's just matter in motion. It's a world of total flux, total chance. So when I, as a human being, my brain is caught, as you know, in evolution, cows just matter in motion. I'm just matter in motion. My brain's just matter in motion. My conclusions, therefore, about any subject, including scientific and theoretical, philosophical ones, are just to do with the way the chemicals, the atoms shake down in my brain. And you may come to different conclusions, and that's just the way the atoms are colliding in your brain. But is one atomic accident right and the other atomic accident wrong? Right? In a chaotic world of flux and change, there is no right and wrong. So the evolutionist must, you know, the join the dots, remember just those dots on the page, comes to a world of brute facts, uncreated facts, and tries to give them a meaning. Whereas the Christian the creationist comes to the world and discovers the meaning that's already there. So Darwin's doubt, and then the whole question of God's order and structure, the fact that creation is either meaning or it's meaningless. If it's meaningless, it doesn't matter what scientific theories you come up with, they bear no relationship to, they are, it's not knowledge. It's just, let's pretend the world has a meaning.
Yeah, there was a quote in one of my lectures today from an atheistic professor talking about the fact that in his estimation, if evolution was true, there is no meaning to life and there's no, you know, judgment. There's nothing. He said no meaning, no way to have ethics or morality or free will or anything. And you've got many naturalists now coming to the point of what they call chemical predestination. And you've even got lawyers who are atheists now that are arguing against the Christian view of law. And what they're saying is, whatever actions a human being takes, that's only because of chemical predestination. As Joe's saying, these chemicals fizzing around in your head under these circumstances are making me react the way I'm reacting right now. I'm not actually thinking things through and stuff. It's just that that's the way my brain is fizzing and that's the way you're perceiving me and all this stuff. And so they're actually starting to argue that, you know, even someone commits a horrendous act, well, maybe they're not really guilty because they just did those things under that specific environment because that's the way their chemicals are fizzing. And think about that. Under that, you can't be held responsible for any of your activities. And yet, that's what the fellow that I quoted was saying. So, you know, you lose... You lose a lot when you give up the God of the Bible to try to explain and live life in a real world when you jettison that. So it's something to definitely think about philosophically as well.
And I think one of the things I would just say, you can hear these guys, and obviously they've both sat for a lot of Q&A sessions. And the more conversations you have, the more comfortable you will get at getting into and getting out of particular arguments. Right? This isn't the first time that Cal or Joe have used those arguments. So the more conversations you have, the better you get at articulating things, at responding to questions, at pulling at the knowledge of the things that you've learned. So I would just encourage you, like, don't think that you have to have it as polished and precise as these guys do, because that's happened because of how many times they've gone over this material. So the more comfortable you are in conversations, the easier you'll find that this is a particular thing that I'm comfortable sharing. So I can maneuver in the conversation in such a way that I can get to. Might not be the best argument for that particular person. You won't know that, but it's certainly something that you are comfortable articulating. I think, Megan, you had your hand up as well.
Yeah, I have a couple questions.
So the question is, how would you evangelize somebody who's transgender?
You gonna punt it to me first again?
No. Well, you both seem pretty hot and bothered about the opening of the Olympics today.
Yeah,
so
yeah. That's true.
Well, I think I don't think it matters that they're trans. I don't think it matters that they're gay. I don't think it matters that they're whatever. Insert sin here, okay? I think when you're evangelizing someone, you can talk about the same things that God's law talks about, okay? That's a very specific situation they're in and something they're participating in and stuff. But the fact is, I wasn't trans and I needed to hear the gospel. And when the preacher started talking about God's law, lying, stealing, adultery, even in your mind, you know, blaspheming, all that stuff. I fell under condemnation because I fall under all of that. I might not have dressed up like a lady every now and then, but I still needed just to hear the gospel. So, you know, could there be some sensitivity there? I think when people are living a homosexual lifestyle or they're participating in the trans movement or something like that, that's where they're expecting you to come against a lot of times. Like, you're going to criticize me because I want to do this or live this lifestyle. You can just do the pull a matrix just like that and just get back to, hey, you know what God's law says? It says that all liars have their place in the lake of fire. Have you ever lied? Well, they are, because they're saying they're a woman when they're a man, or a man or a woman. But anyway, they're not going to bring that. But I hope you're taking my point. I don't think that needs to be the crux of the conversation. Just the same thing that I felt guilty to.
Yeah, I think that's the right answer, is that they need the gospel. So I want to tweak it a little bit and get Joe to jump in on this. So because it kind of ties into your first lecture when you're talking about identity. Because I think one of the hard things about evangelism to anybody in that sort of LGBT spectrum is that they, not many liars make lying part of their I, part of their internal being. But a lot of people in the LGBT community, it becomes so entwined with their identity. So how would you kind of approach that with somebody who had that that identity so wrapped into them? How would you have that conversation?
Mm-hmm. Well, if some of you guys remember the first lecture where I talked about worldview and identity in Christ, I think I would tease out some of those key points, that the self is a project, you know, the self is a task. And the question is, are we going to accept that there is a givenness to the self, that we are creatures and we're not God, we don't have absolute freedom, we only have the freedom of a creature, and that the meaning of our lives is accountability to God, relationship with God, accountability to God, so that he determines the givenness of our existence, and then we have to make choices in that context, whether we're going to seek God, seek relationship with God, and be obedient to God and discover who we are, because we talked about the fact that he's created every single person with a particular purpose in mind, or whether we're going to reject the givenness of our person and say, I'm going to be my own God. Now, the person in these sorts of lifestyles knows, actually, within their own being, that they are trying to live a lie. They know they're living in untruth. One of the reasons why there's this radical insistence that everybody celebrates, everybody wears the badge, all the banks feature it, or that it's at the Olympics, that it's up, you can't get away from it, is because there is such a sense of guilt and shame in the lives of these people that they need to make the world affirm what they're doing. Everybody must affirm. The church must affirm. Schools must affirm. Government must affirm. Law must affirm. Not just affirm, celebrate. There must be pride marches in what you're doing. Why the necessity for this, the volume, the intensity of this? And it's because they cannot allow that any area of life, the family or the church or any area, be allowed to raise the issue of creational normativity, of God's order. Because as soon as that is raised, guilt and shame is revived. So their hope is that somehow, if I can alter the society and make society celebrate untruth and sin, then I won't feel guilt and shame anymore. It doesn't work. It doesn't matter how much propaganda is there. It doesn't work. It doesn't change the inner sense of identity crisis. It doesn't alter the sense of guilt and shame. So, but that's why it's done. It's an attempt to try and, if you don't have the atonement of Christ for sin, you have to try and blot it out in some other way. And so that's what's actually happening. So the choice fundamentally in terms of evangelism is, as Cal rightly says, part of the problem is we think that we have to design a sort of unique, special gospel for every type of sin. We don't. The gospel is the gospel. For lawbreakers, and we're all sinners. Now, we may have become very creative in how we disguise our sin and dress up our sin and label our sin and so forth, give it a scientific veneer, give it a sociological veneer, but it's sin. Deep down at the root of our being, people know when they're living in untruth. The louder they get, the more they want to stamp out anybody's ability to say anything about that, the more insecure they are in their doubt and in their untruth. That's why evolutionists are so loud. It's the insecurity that exists within the position itself. So there has to be a compassion and an empathy because of the struggle for identity. And then we have to offer Christ as the one who alone brings rest for the self, right? That the identity you're striving for, you're looking for, you're searching for is found only in and through your Creator and Redeemer. That crisis is met in and through the Lord Jesus Christ. Here is how you discover who you really are. This is how you discover the thing you're longing for and yearning for, to discover your identity. It's found here in your Creator. But so, yes, you can affirm the self is a task, but in order to be yourself, you have to know who you are. That's only possible within the givenness of the creational worldview. If you reject that, you're lost, and yourself is nothing more than a disposable wrapper. It might feel solid one day, it will feel utterly fragile and ephemeral, and the wind can blow it away the next.
That's good. Megan, I think you said you had a couple questions.
I'm going to snag that one. Yeah, it's so interesting to me. If you look at the history of the church, up until about 200 plus years ago, everyone knew what the word day in Genesis meant, right? If you looked up older treatises on scripture and stuff like that, you never saw something like gap theory, day age theory, framework hypothesis, theistic evolution. None of this appeared in the theological marketplace. That only happened once old earth ideas and then the story of evolution started to become popularized within Western culture. And then the church, under pressure to somehow not seem like science denying or, not rational, then decided, well, maybe we can fudge the scripture to make this mean that or whatever like that. And so the word day, that was the first thing that really got, in a sense, examined. And I was having a conversation with someone today where I just mentioned there have been so many times where I've had Christians say something to me like this, like, well, Cal, the word day, in Genesis doesn't always mean a literal day. The word yom, which is the Hebrew word day, doesn't have to mean a literal day. As if they're saying something profound to me. I'm like, oh, wow.
Better
that's amazing.
Cancel AIG.
I know. Just forget the
whole world
ministry. Yeah. What? The word day doesn't have to mean day? Boy, what a zinger. And so I remind them, well, of course it doesn't. Just like in English, the word day doesn't have to mean the word day, right? If I said to you guys, hey, look, back in my father's day, it took 3 days to drive to Nova Scotia during the day. Anybody confused? No, because of context. Back in my father's day, is that a literal day? No, that was when my dad was young and hip or whatever, right? He's passed away now. But back in my father's day, it took 3 days to drive to Nova Scotia. Were those real days? Yeah, 3 days. To drive to Nova Scotia during the day, is that a complete day? No, that's the daylight portion of a day. So you all understood what I was saying in context because you understand English. The question isn't, can the word day in Genesis mean something other than the word 24-hour day? The question is, when does the word yom, used in Genesis, mean a 24-hour day? And so as we often point out, you can look in the Old Testament and the word yom is used over 2,300 times. And whenever it is used with the addition of the word evening, morning, or a number, it is always assumed to be a literal 24-hour day. And then you go to the text in Genesis, evening, morning, number, first day, evening, morning, number, second day, evening, morning, number, third day. I mean, God couldn't have made it more plain that he was talking about a literal 24-hour day. Okay. And then, of course, in behind that comes a huge theological problem, which many Christians haven't thought through. If you try to say that the word day doesn't mean day and it means long ages, and there's a purpose behind that, because there's only one place to try to put the concept of deep time into the Bible. It has to be in the 6 days of creation, because you can't put it after Adam and Eve come in on the scene. So people who are trying to say that the word day doesn't mean day is what they're really trying to do is put long ages in the 6 days of creation. But I'm always warning them that the evidence that the Bible skeptics are saying points to the proof of millions of years is primarily the rock layers. They point to the rock layers and say, this is proof of these things having been laid down over millions and millions of years of deep time. But it's not just the rock layers. It's what's in the rock layers. And what's in the rock layers is a record of death and suffering and disease like cancer. Now, as a biblical creation, I would say, well, that makes sense, because after the fall of Adam, 1,650 years later, there was a global flood. God said he was going to send it to destroy all flesh on land. What would you expect to find? Billions of dead things buried in sedimentary waterborne layers, which is exactly what we find. So it fits the evidence, fits the scripture, and it's death after sin comes into being, not before. Because otherwise, you're saying that Jesus, the creator, as revealed in the book of Colossians, used millions and millions of years of death, suffering, disease to create. And at the end, he called it very good. And that was all before Adam sinned. And so what's the wages of sin? Death. But it was there prior to Adam sinning. So it really just does away with the gospel when you think about it. It's a huge issue. And I wish more Christians would take the time to really look into these things more deeply. That's why the ministry exists.
I got a couple of thoughts on that, as you might expect. The one is, when you look at the ministry of Jesus, what's one of the things that Jesus did most in the Gospels? That so many of the accounts in the Gospels are actually about. What is Jesus doing?
Miracles.
Miracles. And what are they usually? Miracles of healing, right? The Gospel of John calls these signs. Signs to what? Well, if evolution were true, death, disease, why would Jesus be concerned with healing disease, since disease is the engine of life? These are signs that are pointing to the restoration of all things, to the new creation, to the renewed creation, when the curse is undone. So he's not pointing forward to an era of death, disease, decay, and suffering. No, the signs are pointing forward to the restoration, the healings and the resurrections are pointing forward to the restoration of all things. So that's really important. Day is also critically God with his own finger. If we were left in any doubt at all about the meaning of day in Exodus chapter 20, he tells us himself, he writes it in stone. In 6 days, God created the heavens and the earth. And he gives us there in the law, this is in the law of God, a pattern for us of the working week. So our pattern is to follow him. So it's not just Genesis, it's in the law of God. When God writes with his own finger his law, he tells us he created the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh he rested, and that's the pattern for us. So are you going to rest for, I don't know, Monday's a million years, Tuesday's a million years? so you're going to work for a million, we're going to work for 6 million or 6 billion, and then rest for a billion years? No, these are days. So God himself tells us that. And so it's critically important that we actually take that seriously.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing about the whole question about the days, the 6 days of creation, it all comes down to biblical authority. It's not about whether God used evolution or God, used millions of years or all this stuff. It's, can I go to my Bible and just look at it and what it plainly says, I can understand it? Because as I said, for the first, 1,750 years, 1,800 years of the church, everybody knew what Genesis meant. That's why I mentioned one of the videos I made called Augustine was a young earth creationist, because some people try to point to Augustine and say, well, he didn't believe that God created in 6 literal days. Well, that's true. He believed God created in an instant, but I've done my research and I did the video. He believed the earth was less than 6,000 years old. He believed Noah's flood was a real event, and he believed God created ex nihilo. I have looked at all the church fathers, not one of them believed in millions of years. Not one. So the majority of the church fathers, all of them, the vast majority of the average lay Christian and the reformers all believed that the earth was young because of what the plain reading of the Word of God says. And so if suddenly now science comes along and says, oh no, we got to redo our understanding of Scripture. Well, they say all sorts of things like, oh, people are born with the gay gene. Do we just accept that and add it to the Scripture or... Right? So it's something serious for sure.
In fact, the pagans actually, in Augustine's time, their objection wasn't why you need millions of years. Their objection was, why does God need 6 days? What does God need 6 days for? Why didn't you just do it in an instant? Which is one of the reasons that Augustine held that view, because that was a popular view at the time. Right, that creation should be instantaneous. Why would God have an ordered process? Why does he need those number of days? God should do it like that.
I think I saw Sophie's hand. Yeah, go for it.
This is kind of...
It's the boot dart. I've written a book on that.
Everybody buy my book.
Everybody get the book. You've lived for 700 years.
Yeah, so the question was, in terms of entropy and the fact that the genome is declining, is that the reason why lifespans of humans were so much longer in the Bible?
I would definitely say that that's a major factor. So mutation or genetic load is well known among population geneticists, whether you're a creationist or an evolutionist. There have been... population geneticists that have admitted that within the next 20 generations on Earth, human beings are going to experience serious mental and physical deterioration, basically. And I believe I've already seen that in my own lifetime because I, you know, was born in 1966. And I remember as a kid, I didn't remember all these, you know, things like birth defects and allergies and a wide variety of things that I've seen pop up, you know. Now, some of those might be due to environment and stuff like that, but not all. So mutational load is a real is a reality. We know that every generation starts in the hole from the one previous. And so if you know, if it's doing this, worse, go back in time, better. In the beginning, everything is very good, right? So one of the main reasons why you will get old and die if you don't die an unnatural death is because of the mutations that accumulate in your body, okay? So considering that, now apply it to biblical history. I always like to use the example of Abraham and Sarah, and they're wandering, they're sojourning around. Twice, as they're doing so, a fellow wants Sarah, okay? And the second time, it's a pharaoh or king or something, and wants Sarah for his harem. Now, I always like to point out to people, did you ever notice how old Sarah was when this event occurred? She was 90.
Still right? A babe.
So... You know, I don't know what it's like for you guys where you live, but I don't go to, you know, the mall in London and see a bunch of young bucks walking around going, oh, nice walker. You know, I don't see that happening, right? You know, nice tooth, you know, like, so obviously Sarah looked a little bit different than the average or, you know, male or female 90-year-old, right? Because, and I believe that was directly because there would be a lack of mutations have built up. It also relates to the fact that it isn't until 2,500 years after creation that God institutes a law against close intermarriage. Previous to that, close intermarriage is very normal. And the reason, one of the main reasons why you don't marry someone closely related to you today is because of genetic mutation. If you marry someone close to you today, the chance of you inheriting the same mutation at the same location in the DNA is greatly increased. And so your best bet for, you know, better health, so to speak, is to marry someone, you know, not closely genetically related to you. And so, yeah, it actually fits quite well with biblical history to think of it like that, what we see in science. And I'd say that would be a very good explanation.
One thing that, not to go on a bunny trail, but one thing that I think is interesting, probably worth talking about some other time, is that when you look at some of the, it's actually quite incredible what scientists have been able to do with things like stem cells. Completely immoral, unethical in terms of how they've acquired those stem cells. But it's interesting that a lot of the greatest scientific discoveries in the last several hundred years happened when our nations had a predominantly Christian worldview, and the predominant scientists and those who are in sort of making scientific and medical discoveries had a biblical world and life view, and we're looking at the world as a discoverer in the world. What did God make these things for? Now you have a bunch of pagans with a non-biblical worldview who are doing unethical things. And you wonder what it would be like if some of this incredible advancement in medical and technological advancement was actually being done once again predominantly by Christians with a Christian worldview. So just as a side note there in terms of, because the question might be, what's going to happen? James, Josiah, you guys can arm wrestle real quick. They didn't arm wrestle, just for anybody who can't see. Listen. Yeah, good question. So
okay, no, number one, I didn't plant that dude over there. Okay. Just to let everybody know, I'm here as a guest at the camp to speak on behalf of the Answers in Genesis ministry. And so in a Q&A time, I typically avoid any denominationally based questions. That's not my purpose to be here. Okay. So I'm going to let these two gentlemen address that. I'm not going to speak to it. You need to also understand that I'm just one of several speakers in Answers in Genesis. And there are several different denominational backgrounds from all of our different speakers. So if you asked us each our personal viewpoint on certain things, on secondary issues, we might give you a wide variety of answers because that's our personal opinion. But as far as the ministry goes, I'm here to just answer questions about Genesis 1 to 11. I know it pertains in the way you're looping it in there, but yeah, I'm bowing out on my, I don't have a personal opinion on denominational based issues when I'm representing the Answers in Genesis ministry.
I'll take a moment just to highlight something, then I'll actually let Joe answer that question for you. Yeah, I'm going to pass it on. But I do think it is interesting, and James just pointed out that there are different eschatological perspectives up here, and I think that's one of the things that's beautiful about this is that we believe that 6-day creation and having a creational worldview is so important that Cal and I have partnered on a variety of various ministries, and we do ministry together all the time, partially because I think overall, regardless of an eschatological position, the church would be much stronger if the church could stand together on these issues, Genesis 1 to 11. So I'll say that, and then I'll ask Joe the question about how does the resurrection of Christ, if you want to respond to that at all.
Yeah, I think the question is probably related to the issue of, okay, scientific theories around genetic entropy, and then how might that relate to different eschatological perspectives. I think the first thing to say is there are all kinds of scientific hypotheses and theories. Some are going to be shown to be right, some are going to be shown to be wrong. Second, there are all kinds of theological theories, and some will be right and some will be wrong. So, you know, in some respects, the different theological perspectives on eschatology will look at and account for that evidence and those theories in a different way. Let's say, for example, that you happen to be one of those people who had a more optimistic eschatology. Well, you might look at things like the change in scripture. First of all, tells us that God tells us to expect 70 as, you know, a sort of baseline average, 70 years. And if by reason of strength, scripture says 80. So if you get 70, you're doing well. If you get 80, that's a bonus. Lots of people these days are living well beyond that. In fact, you know, we do have an aging population, mainly because actually of clean water. That's the main reason. Nothing to do with vaccination, by the way. Maybe scratch that from the podcast. Clean water, improved diet, gainful employment, standard of living, basically, these things, you know, family situation also affects, actually employment affects your life expectancy, your family situation, and so on. So there's a, because human beings are an integral reality, we're not just biological, biochemical organisms, many, many things affect our health and our longevity in life, many things, economic, social, cultural, and so on. So there's lots of reasons why we could think that actually human life expectancy actually until very recently, I think we've just reached a bit of a tipping point as people's standards of living and the way people are living is starting to bring down, you know, fast food, weight issues in the Western world, but also sexual promiscuity is very, very bad for your health. That's another subject, but basically, you know, the science, modern science tells us that you're, how do I put this delicately, that your bodily fluids are meant to be exchanged with only one other person. And the body can deal with that. If you have multiple partners, the body can no longer deal with all these foreign fluids. So that's what sexually transmitted diseases are. That's why promiscuity is so detrimental to health. So there's a whole load of things that contribute to our health. And another thing is that just as Cal talks about and Nate talked about the advancement of scientific developments, technological developments, that is part of the cultural mandate. Now, we have to do it in a godly way, but the dominion mandate tells us that we're to rule and subdue, we're to take the resources of God's creation, and we're to turn it into a kingdom culture. And that will involve seeking to bring rest and relief to the consequences of the curse. When you think about almost every great business idea, think about what you're sitting on right now, right? Why do we sit on chairs? Well, it's much more comfortable than sitting on a damp floor. So a chair is a piece of technology that was designed to give rest and relief to the reality of being human in a fallen world, right? And if you look at almost everything that's sold, foods, products, everything else, lamps, mattresses, everything. It's all about giving rest and relief to human beings in a fallen world. It's about bringing God shalom. So we use human technology to do that. Now, who's to say that as technology moves forward and is recovered by the Christian world and life view, that we don't make technological discoveries that allow us to look at the things that are causing genetically inherited diseases and do something about it? So that would be another way in which somebody who has a more optimistic eschatology might look at that. Those who have a more pessimistic eschatology about the future might take that in a different direction.
Josiah, why don't you wrap us up here, guys?
I am yeah, optimistic ahead. About the future, brother.
Just yeah, so you know. I know that.
Jesus is
we all
come
agree,
back.
Agree Jesus wins, right?
We all agree Jesus wins and Christ
exactly.
comes back.
I'm very optimistic about that.
Yeah. Cal and I often say to each other, if we're wrong, we'll deal with, like, if I'm wrong, I'll change my theology in midair. And Cal says if he's wrong, he'll change his theology. Yeah, so.
You know what I meant, brother, didn't you?
Go ahead, Josiah. That's a great question. So, and you have a theologian, philosopher, and a scientific theologian to answer the question. So the question is, in terms of generational curses, is there anything that we can observe scientifically that may contribute to that? And is that still the same, maybe new covenant as it was old covenant?
I'm going to say no and punt to Joe.
I think you'll have a better answer.
The generational sin is just something that where patterns of sinful behavior are handed down from one generation to the next, and God visits on the children's children the sins of the fathers. So, you know, we are living through that right now in our culture. You know, my grandparents' generation, the silent generation, did not adequately pass on the faith. They went through a great deal of suffering. They were the war generation, but they didn't adequately pass on the faith to my parents' generation. My parents' generation give us the sexual and social revolution. My generation then becomes the first generation of children growing up in radically broken homes. They're then trying to raise my children's generation now who don't even know who they are. Male and female identity. So that is the sin of the fathers being visited to the third and fourth generation. But God says, blessing to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, of course, you know, generation, the curse, you know, which, and the curse that, you know, we read about in Genesis has passed throughout all the generations, right? It's every single generation is affected by the curse. But when God breaks in with redemption in Jesus Christ, that's interrupted. And things where we've been in patterns as families and as societies for a long time. And it's, you know, when you look at various different cultures and you look at some of the sins that they handed down generation after generation in terms of idolatry, in terms of sexual immorality, in terms of things like child sacrifice, cannibalism, you could look right across the world. Until the gospel of Jesus Christ interrupts it, you see those things passed down. So I think the thing to focus on is that there's 1,000 generations who will know, and that's a long time into the future, 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Blessing.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, well, we'll wrap it up there. We are doing another Q&A in a couple of nights. It'll be... Dr. Joe Boot and I believe Dr. Ted Fenske will be doing that one. So if you have more questions, there's plenty of time to ask. That's what we're here for. Thanks for coming, Cal. Thanks for spending the day here. I know it was a hot day, but we had a lot of fun. You guys enjoy Cal today?
Thanks, Cal.
There's no Wi-Fi here, but if there was, you would all be going on to the Answers in Genesis Canada page, YouTube channel, and subscribing. Yeah, you're all going to do that when you get home, yes? Already subscribed. There you go. Extra bubbly. Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for joining us, Cal. Thanks, everybody who is here. And just a reminder for all our podcast listeners that, as always, we remind you that from him and through him and to him are all things. Stay tuned because we have a couple of exciting podcasts as we wrap up the rest of August. And we'll see you soon.